Welcome to Central Bark, a podcast from Guide Dogs for the Blind. I'm Teresa Sturr, and I'm your host. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Central Bark. We have a very special episode today. We are speaking with Dr. Ariel Silverman, who works for the American Foundation for the Blind, and GDB and the American Foundation for the Blind partnered on a two-year research project looking into the future of guide dog use in the United States and Canada. So today, I'm so excited to welcome Ariel. Welcome, Ariel.
Thank you so much, Teresa.
So Ariel, tell us a little bit about your background and about what you do at AFB.
Absolutely. So I have a doctorate in social psychology from the University of Colorado Boulder. I've received that 8 years ago. So I've always had an interest in kind of science and research and learning about human behavior. And I've also been blind since birth. So I've always been passionate about using research and data to make lives better for blind people and people with low vision by understanding some of the barriers or some of the factors in the environment that can create challenges for blind people, people with low vision, and figuring out solutions to those barriers. So after I completed my doctoral training, I did a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Washington, and I learned some different methodologies and learned about different types of disabilities and things like that. For 5 years, I was self-employed as a consultant, working with different organizations to help them with their research. And I also did some disability awareness and inclusion training. And then in January of 2021, I started working with the American Foundation for the Blind, first as a consultant, assisting with some of their research, including the work that we'll talk about today. And then I joined the AFB team full-time as a research specialist in September of 2021 and became the director of research in April of 2022. So I joined the team kind of in the middle of the collaboration with GDB.
That's great. It's been great having you on this project. I think it's especially helpful that you have a, you know, that you're visually impaired too. You kind of get all the sort of the nuances that come along with this. And so it's been really fun working with you on this. One of the reasons that Guide Dogs for the Blind decided to do this type of research is because there's very little in the field about guide dogs. There's very little research about blindness or guide dogs, and very, very, very little about guide dogs, if we could say it that way. But I think it was really important for us at Guide Dogs for the Blind to make sure that our services remain relevant as we move forward into the future. So this was really important research for us. And we also felt like this is research that could be shared industry-wide. So with other agencies who serve people visually impaired, and especially with other guide dog programs. So again, it's been really fun working with you on this. So Ariel, can you tell us a little bit about sort of the design of the study and who participated?
Yeah, so we wanted to do a mixed method study, meaning that part of it was, you know, getting statistics from folks, and part of it was getting more open-ended responses to questions and learning more like about people's stories with guide dogs and travel. First of all, we went and reviewed the literature to learn what other researchers had done and what they had found about guide dogs. And we found that there was indeed not a whole lot of research about guide dogs. And it was hard even to identify like a prevalence estimate for the percentage of folks who use guide dogs in the US. After that, we did a survey. So we had 533 individuals, and about half of them were guide dog users and the other half were not, but all blind and low vision individuals complete a survey. So we were able to get some like statistical information that way. And then after that, we interviewed some folks, and we started out by interviewing GDB clients and staff to really drill down into some questions about what GDB does well and maybe areas that GDB could improve on, and learning more in depth about people's experiences going through GDB's programs and some of the ways that GDB staff kind of adapt to challenges or, you know, what kind of their outlook on guide dog use. We started with GDB folks, and then we expanded and did interviews and focus groups with guide dog users from other schools, staff from other schools, and particularly guide dog users from different groups. So people who were young adults who were, had just gotten their first dog, people who were older adults who had had like up to 11 guide dogs in their lives, people with additional disabilities, people who identified as people of color. We also included 6 O&M instructors to get their perspective. And at one point we said, well, you know, why are we just talking to guide dog users? If we really want to understand the landscape, we need to also talk to people who have decided not to use guide dogs. And we had some of that from the survey, but we wanted to get more in-depth look at their experiences. So we included 8 people who did not use a guide dog, who used a cane. We also included 2 people who did not use a guide dog or a cane. There were people with low vision who did not use mobility aids at all. So it really gave us a very broad cross-section of the community, and we were able to understand multiple perspectives on some of these issues.
Yeah, definitely. And I think one of the things that surprised me the most, which is probably because I'm not sort of a techie person, but was kind of in the area where we were looking at trends of people who are traveling now. And I believe you found that most people who, you know, work with a guide dog are also using some sort of technology along with their guide dog or with their cane to sort of navigate their world. Can you talk a little bit about that finding?
Yeah. So on the survey, when we asked people what tools they use during travel, one of the options that they could select was that they use a smartphone. And about 3/4 of the respondents indicated that they use a smartphone during travel. And that was about the same for the guide dog users and the non-guide dog users who were surveyed. And of course, some of those folks probably just said that they use a smartphone because they have it with them and maybe they like listen to music on the train or something like that. But in the interviews, most of the respondents did indicate that they use smartphone apps specifically to assist with travel. And we dug a little deeper and we asked, like, you know, what apps do you use and how do you use those apps? And the responses, I think, fell into 2 main categories. So a lot of people said they use like GPS wayfinding apps, and those could be either mainstream apps like Apple Maps or Google Maps, or it could be blindness apps like Nearby Explorer or Blind Square or Soundscapes, which is one that I had actually not heard of that I might want to try.
That's pretty cool. I've tried that one. Yeah.
Yeah. The Soundscapes came up multiple times. So they said they use it for, you know, route planning ahead of time and also turn-by-turn navigation while they're traveling. The second group of apps were visual interpreting apps, which of course are fairly recent. So things like Be My Eyes and Aira. And of course, those apps cannot replace a cane or a guide dog, but they were often cited as providing kind of supplemental support, if particularly if someone got turned around and they needed help like navigating, you know, back on course, or if they were going to an unfamiliar place and they needed to find like the specific room in a building, for example. They found visual interpreting apps to be really helpful for that.
Ariel, for those of our listeners who maybe not have had much experience with apps for folks with visual impairment, those new interpretive services are really kind of different. Can you kind of explain to our listeners how that works?
Sure. So these are apps where you essentially, it's like a FaceTime call. It's like a video call with someone on the other end who is sighted, who can see, you know, whatever's in the camera view and provide support. In the case of Aira, they actually have professionally trained agents that they hire and pay to provide the service. And in the case of Be My Eyes, it's volunteers around the world who provide the service. And so people can call in and they can ask questions. So for example, it might be aiming their camera looking for a sign in a building to find the specific like suite number that they need. It could be looking as they're walking down the street to be able to find a specific landmark that might not be obvious non-visually. And in the case of Aira, at least, they can also help with online resources. So you can call and say, can you look on the map and tell me like what restaurants are around me, for example. And Aira provides a GPS point to the agent so they can tell exactly where the user is and can provide feedback that's requested.
Very cool. Very cool. Do they do your homework if you're in high school? No, just kidding. So
probably depends on what agent you get.
Yes, I know. If they got me, I wouldn't be able to do the math. That's for sure. All right. Another trend you know, that kind of came up, I think, during the survey. And it's kind of interesting that our survey happened to sort of fall around the time of the pandemic. But it does seem like a lot of the respondents were saying that their travel has sort of changed over the years, and probably especially with the pandemic. Can you talk a little bit about that, and then a little bit about sort of the double-edged sword of ride shares?
Sure. So regarding the pandemic, there was a pattern of people talking about, which we all know, workplaces went remote. So people weren't necessarily like having a regular routine of going out and going to work in the office. And now it's kind of a hodgepodge in terms of some workplaces still being remote, some workplaces being like hybrid or partially in person, and then some being fully back in person. But overall, people weren't going out as much because we were doing these interviews when the pandemic was still in full force and vaccines were just barely starting up. And so people definitely reported like a reduction in their activity levels. But there was also a pattern of people talking about like maybe not walking a lot of places, because rideshare is a really convenient way to get from one place to another directly without having to stop and wait for a bus and,
yep.
and those kinds of inconveniences. So people commented on like the fact that they didn't necessarily walk a lot of places because they were going door to door in a car. And sometimes like the guide dog users would say that they had to kind of build into their routine like walking opportunities for the dog, so the dog still got work.
Yeah.
You know, it was more of a challenge for some folks than for others, depending on where they lived and what was available in the neighborhood and how walkable their neighborhood was. And rideshare, of course, provides a lot of convenience, but also creates a barrier in a lot of cases for guide dog users because of the high rate of service denials with rideshare drivers. Like they see the dog and then they just cancel the ride, or they come up with some reason. And sometimes even, it didn't come up in this study so much, but I've heard just among my friends that in the wake of COVID, that drivers will even like lie and say that the person is not wearing their mask
in order to
get away with not taking them with their dog, which is terrible.
It
ends up, you know, negatively impacting the rider, of course. And so this came up repeatedly as, so for example, when we ask questions about like, are there any places you would not take your dog to? People would say like, well, if I'm in a huge hurry and I need to get to an appointment on time, I might like hesitate to take my dog because I'm afraid that I'm like Uber or Lyft is not going to take me.
Yeah. That's so frustrating.
It also came up, of course, in terms of like advocacy challenges, having to advocate with the drivers. And then on the flip side, people who didn't have dogs would say like, well, I don't want to deal with that. Like I use Lyft and Uber all the time. I don't want to have to worry about them not possibly denying me because I have a dog. So that was like a deterrent from getting a dog for some folks.
Wow. That's so crazy. Like something that's really could be super helpful in terms of inclusion, also being sort of a deterrent to really personal choices to how you want to get around the world. That's a little distressing. Yeah. So tell us about what surprised you or what sort of hit you when you asked people why they chose to have a guide dog, to work with a guide dog.
So I don't know if it necessarily surprised me because I know a lot of guide dog users.
That's true.
I've actually one of the people who chose not to use a guide dog, but I have a lot of friends and colleagues who do. And, you know, they talked about the practical benefits as well as the emotional benefits of having a dog. I think what maybe is interesting, I guess not really surprising, but just interesting, is socially, the guide dog can be also like a double-edged sword. So some people said that having a dog like made social interactions like smoother and people were more likely to approach them and be more positive. Whereas like if they had a cane, people would like distance themselves or be kind of fearful of the cane, or they would have a different stereotype about like cane users not being very independent. But if they had a dog, they felt like people viewed them as a lot more positively. Then on the other side, though, there are a lot of challenges, particularly with people like interfering with the guide dog in different ways, like petting or feeding or talking to the dog. Of course, even when they say, you know, you can't do that, please don't do that, people would persist at it. Some people talked about like family and friends didn't quite get like how the dog worked. For example, they would try to continue to try to guide. Like they would get upset if it looked like the person was about to run into something and the person would be like, no, my dog, it can see it and will take me around it. Their family didn't always understand that.
That makes sense. Yeah.
So like socially and interpersonally, the guide dog can be great, but it can also present some unique challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. As a guide dog user myself, I can say yes, indeed, to all of the above. Oh my goodness. So, I know you talked to some people who weren't using guide dogs, and was there any barriers there that you felt like were kind of sort of misconceptions about guide dogs that maybe, we can kind of bridge those gaps for folks?
So there were some folks who indicated that they believed that people with like a lot of residual vision either like wouldn't be allowed to get a dog or they wouldn't benefit, or that like they were taking a dog away from someone who was totally blind, who was perceived as being more deserving or more needy, perhaps. And there's definitely like some truth to the fact that you have to meet certain criteria vision-wise in order to qualify to get a guide dog. But there's not necessarily like the shortage or rationing of guide dogs that some people might perceive there to be. And people who had low vision definitely indicated that having a guide dog, as long as they were legally blind, having a guide dog was still helpful and increased their independence and freedom and confidence. So I think that that's definitely a misconception that can be addressed, is understanding that even if you have significant usable vision, as long as you know how to balance that with trusting the dog and working with the dog appropriately, that can still be beneficial. I guess the other thing that's just maybe concerning is the shortage of O&M services was frequently cited as a barrier or reason why people either self-selected out of getting a guide dog or were denied
Ah, okay. Yes.
because they didn't have the O&M. And I mean, that's something that definitely intervention needs to be introduced to provide more O&M services to more folks, not just so they can get guide dogs, but so they can just have all the tools available to them to be more independent.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's really a dearth of that service for folks, and it seems like it's getting worse. So I know here at Guide Dogs for the Blind, we are providing an orientation mobility immersion program for that very reason. So we'll have to do another central bark about that, I think.
Yeah. And then finally, I would say just the And we talked about this earlier, but the fact that people often just weren't doing enough walking to justify having a guide dog is also interesting. And some folks said that like they had a guide dog and they wanted it to have another one, but they couldn't because they lived in a place that wasn't conducive to a lot of walking.
Right. And I think a lot of the way that new communities are being built, they're built more for vehicles than pedestrians. So I can see that kind of being a barrier as well. Yeah, very good. So, Miss Ariel, it sounds like you and I are going to be hitting the road soon to kind of share what we've learned on this. Can you tell us a little bit about what's coming up for our partnership?
Absolutely. So we have been accepted to present at the International Guide Dog Federation conference in Vancouver next April. So I'm super excited about that. It'll be a lot of fun.
Yes.
We're also hoping to submit a proposal to speak at the California Transcribers and Educators of the Blind and Visually Impaired annual conference. So that will help us reach out to particularly the O&M community to help them understand maybe some of the ways that orientation and mobility and guide dog professionals can collaborate more and be sure that young people have the information that they need to be able to decide if a guide dog is the right tool for them.
Right. And then I think we're doing a couple articles as well. So again, we're just really going to try to get that word out. So, Ariel, did the study illuminate any particular communities that are really underrepresented in as guide dog users?
Yeah, first of all, cultural minorities or certain cultural groups can sometimes face barriers related to cultural attitudes about dogs generally and about guide dogs in particular. So, for example, we had some participants from like Latino, Latina backgrounds, and they spoke about, as part of their culture, really emphasizing like family interconnectedness and interdependence. And so there was often just a conception that like family members would help each other, and like, why would you need an animal to help you because you have family to support you?
Right.
And so they said, like, even if you have, and they said, like, there's a shortage of guide dog materials in Spanish, but even with materials in Spanish, it's important to help educate those communities about why a guide dog could be beneficial. of course, there's also other cultures where having a dog in the home is not considered appropriate, depending on certain beliefs about dogs in the culture.
Right.
And so people might have difficulty getting like their family to accept a dog in the home. And so it's important for guide dog schools to be aware of those factors.
Mm-hmm.
The other group that we spent a lot of time really looking at is people with additional disabilities. And in the survey, we found that about 1/4 of the respondents said that they have some sort of chronic health condition. And then it was about 10% each for hearing impairments, physical impairments, and mental health disabilities. I mean, I guess the good news is that those conditions were about as common for guide dog users as for non-guide dog users. So it's not, guide dog users aren't, with multiple disabilities aren't necessarily being excluded
right
from the opportunity to get a guide dog. But when we talked with GDB staff, it was clear that GDB staff really make an effort to individualize instruction and accommodate people with various types of disabilities. But we also talked to some folks who were not aware that GDB provides those services.
Uh-huh. Yes.
So some schools like have a reputation for being like especially good for deafblind people or people with certain types of disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so if GDB wants to stay ahead of that curve, we made some recommendations about how to be more explicit in outreach and recruiting to be clear that those services are provided. There was also feedback about just being sure that folks are more aware of mental health disabilities and like some of the mental health impacts of things that can happen with a guide dog, like if the dog gets sick or retires, or, you know, there's a match that doesn't work out. And sometimes even just like the overwhelm of going through training could be hard for people with mental health disabilities, but they can do it if they have the right support.
That's right. That's right. That's such great information we got from this study. And I'm so excited to get this information out to the world so that we can all provide better services for people who are blind or low vision, and really let people know what their options are in terms of getting around independently and with confidence. And I've really appreciated having you here today, Ariel, and I look forward to working with you some more on this project.
I do too. Thanks so much.
For more information about Guide Dogs for the Blind, please visit guidedogs.com.